So I'm on the phone here with Doug Becker of Laureate. Doug, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So your company has hit its 15-year mark just recently. You're a very large institution, seen a lot of change and growth. I wondered if you could just take a minute to describe generally the nature of your partnerships around the world, how you generally seek to work with colleges on the ground.
Sure. Well, really the first partnership for Laureate was finding partnerships with entrepreneurs around the world who had founded universities in many countries that needed more capacity for higher education. But in many cases, these entrepreneurs, or maybe the sons or daughters of the entrepreneur who had founded a university, realized that they had taken their institution as far as they knew how. And they needed resources, financial capital, management, and technology to help them expand and better meet the needs of their country. And so for many years, in the early years of Laureate, that was what we did, was to go around the world to identify countries that we felt were experiencing the most severe imbalance of supply and demand, who would really benefit from our assistance and support, and find a partner in each country. And we would typically invest directly in the university as a financial partner and an operating partner with the local entrepreneur. And that's how it really all started. And that's how many of our universities today came into the Laureate family. And then over time,
I was going to say, you're up to operating in 30 countries now, is that correct?
Yes, 30 countries, approximately 80 different higher education institutions, over 200 physical campuses, plus lots of students online, and over 800,000 students currently enrolled in degree programs in accredited institutions around the world.
So obviously difficult to generalize about a network as large as yours, but when you enter in these partnerships, as you describe them, this isn't so much you taking over and running, but really partnering, it sounds like, and offering scale and resources. Is that a general description that works?
Well, it has covered a wide range. I would say in many cases, the most valuable service that they need is management, in which case we really do come in and take over and operate if that's what our partner wants from us. One of the things that we've found is when we talk to policymakers all over the world, I think there are many that feel that universities themselves could be managed better. And this is something that we found was a resource set that we could bring to the table. But over time, we've also now partnered with nonprofit institutions that don't feel the need to be managed by us but want to avail themselves of services from us. We've partnered with public universities, including highly ranked institutions that want, again, not to have us operate them but provide services to them. And we've even partnered directly with government. We have one great example, very large program that we're now administering in Saudi Arabia, where the government wants us to actually build and operate institutions and is prepared to fund the entire initiative, but wants us to provide services directly to them, in that case, including the management of institutions.
Given that spectrum, how does the Laureate brand work? I mean, if you were in a direct management situation or building a new institution, is Laureate a visible brand or a dominant one? Or it sounds like certainly in ones where there's a lot of autonomy, the individual institutions retain a lot of their flavor, it sounds like.
Yes, and that's really essential to what we do. We have a lot of core beliefs and commonalities across all of the institutions, but they are fundamentally intended to be local in nature and to be completely conscious of what the customer preferences are and the cultural differences and the regulatory requirements in their own country. And we think that that's best expressed by having their own identity. So each Laureate University has its own brand and identity, and in some cases, the Laureate brand is added to that as an identifier, a little bit like if you fly in United Airlines, you see that they're part of the Star Alliance, and that conveys a sense of benefits of membership, but you're still on United Airlines.
Right. I know partnerships are an area of, I guess, fluidity, at least in American higher education, and it's sounds like abroad as well, and some tension, frankly. And I know you all recently have had some difficulties around the partnership with Thunderbird, the International Business College, where an accreditor pumped the brakes on that partnership. And I know very little, but some about Chile and in Brazil, where there have been some questions from accreditation bodies or governments about, you know, whether the institutions you're partnering with are still nonprofits strictly. And again, so these are complex issues, all three, I know. But can you talk a little bit about where you see the difficulties and the challenges in partnering in countries where this becomes an issue?
Sure. It's a great question. I have to say, these range of partnerships and our flexibility in being able to pick the type of partnership that works best for the partner has allowed us to really be successful in many and most cases around the world. And we've had partnerships with independent, highly ranked universities like University of Liverpool. We've been partners with them for more than a dozen years now. So these can be very successful, scalable, and where there's a lot of respect for the differences between the two institutions, between us and our partner, and it can work really well. But as you point out, Thunderbird would be an example of one where we just couldn't bring it to fruition, and the creditor was expressed some concerns. I would just summarize that by saying everyone seems to agree that there's an enormous need for innovation in higher education. But innovation, there's no innovation without cost and risk. And we're willing to incur costs and to take risks in order to do good things for institutions, for students, for societies. And we believe if we do that, that it allows us to advance our cause and success as a company. But the regulators have to bear some cost and some risk as well. And to the extent that they're unwilling to do so, of course, they hold the cards. They can stop it. But they can't send both messages, that there's a need for innovation and that they have no willingness to bear cost or risk associated with those innovations. So if you take, for example, Thunderbird, their accreditor, HLC, instructed them to address their the challenges, the financial challenges that that school had after years of declining enrollments. And they brought forward a bold and thoughtful plan that included a partnership with us. And then the accreditor says, no. Or we have a lot of questions that will take such a long time to answer that Thunderbird won't have the time to ever respond. And so I think it's inconsistent for those two messages to be sent. Now, to be fair, I don't think HLC themselves is sending a message saying that there needs to be innovation, but I'm sure they want innovation, and of course, very important other key constituents and policymakers in the United States are strongly advocating the need for innovation. So I would just recommend that I think institutions have to recognize the need for innovation and the fact that there will be some cost and risk associated with it, and certainly we do. And over time, I believe that we will be able to continue to implement many successful partnerships and show the way for how accreditors can fully protect the constituents that they care about while embracing some innovation that's sadly and sorely needed.
Sure. Well, you know, you mentioned Higher Learning Commission and innovation. I know they feel that they get tugged in multiple directions where they're being pushed to encourage innovation, but also to crack down. And in particular, a few years ago, as you know, they faced a lot of heat for what some lawmakers thought here in Washington, not cracking down hard enough on the for-profit industry at large. You know, Lori, it doesn't fit into any box, really. I think you all are unique in the for-profit sector, but, you know, beyond in higher ed writ large. But it did seem as the Thunderbird controversy heated up that at least, you know, some of your critics painted you with that broad for-profit brush. And, you know, I wonder, do you feel that at some points it might be best to stand apart from your peers that are more domestically focused in the industry?
I think it's a great question, and I think we do stand apart. I think that HLC was right to raise standards and crack down on certain aspects of for-profit education And I think that that was not just HLC, but of course also federal policy, congressional inquiries and discussions, and the Department of Education, all focused on remedying what they felt were very serious and issues and needs that, that needed to be addressed in quality, in financial responsibility, and in consumer protection. And I believe that all of those were needed. I believe that the industry has, as a whole, generally really cleaned up its act with the focus and attention that it's received. But from our perspective, we've always stood apart. Most of our work has been outside of the United States. Most of our work has been building universities that are more aspirational, that are higher end. We have medical schools and engineering and business and law and levels of accreditation outside of the United States that are very, very difficult to attain. And so I think we've been very different from the typical U.S. for-profit institution that typically focuses on the vocational education segment. And that's why they've ended up with more vulnerable customers, higher default rates, and a lot of the issues that needed to be corrected. But they also were serving a very important population that might not otherwise have been served. So it's a delicate balance. I think that the for-profit sector has done a lot for ensuring access, especially for minority students in the United States, but I also think that there were plenty of errors made that needed to be corrected, and I encouraged at the time and encourage today regulators to continue to focus on that. However, I do think that the dialogue needs to move on now from what for-profit education can do better to what higher education can do better as a whole. And I really hope that the next round of efforts to lift standards will be a little bit more even-handed in applying new high standards to everyone in higher education and not just those that pay taxes. What I would hate to have is the sort of moral, the moral dimension brought into the equation so that people who pay taxes are suddenly considered to be bad guys. I always like to remind people that being tax exempt is a privilege and that those that enjoy that privilege have to justify why they don't have to pay taxes. So there is an element of for-profit that has become sort of an invocation where people talk about that as very with a level of criticism, and that pains me because it doesn't have to be that way. You could judge each institution on its own results.
Sure. I mean, do you think it would help if folks within the industry spoke a little bit about stratification? You know, like if you were you just did, you know, criticize certain behaviors. If for-profits themselves spoke a little bit about the diversity within the sector, do you think that would help?
You know, I think it would. I think it really depends on who are you speaking to. There are some people that I think are so fixed on the idea that there's something inappropriate or bad about business getting engaged with education that you may never be able to change their mind. And the thing that I don't really understand about that is that almost all of the graduates of higher education are going to go on to work for business in some form or fashion. And so to be organized as a for-profit company allows us to so well understand the needs of employers around the world. I think that's become a huge advantage for us. But we do also have to recognize that forces us to deliver at a higher level in terms of outcomes and to prove that what we're doing isn't just to make a profit. And that's why we've been very focused on outcomes. I think the better way, you mentioned dialogue, but I think the better way is to allow institutions to stand on their track record of the outcomes that they deliver. And we've been able to show very, very strong evidence that our students all over the world graduate at a higher rate than most universities, get a job at a higher rate, and end up with a higher level of pay for their work than other students who would graduate from a typical university in each of those countries. That, I think, ends up being a very powerful way of illustrating our value add and maybe taking that moral debate out of the discussion and focusing more on outcomes and what's best for students.
Sure. Well, looking forward, you know, there's a lot of energy around institutions ramping up their online presence or access more broadly. You know, I look at it as a layperson, some of what you offer is technology and scale to your partners. But there are other players out there that do similar, but you know, different things. I think about Pearson, of course, or academic partnerships in the kind of enabler role of helping colleges go online and tap new markets. How do you see yourself fitting in that competitive landscape as it shifts?
Well, I think the range of services that we can provide is broader. So, first, we have the reach into the 30 countries where we operate. And so our ability to understand students and what they need and how to reach them and how to give them what they want is very strong. So that would allow us to be potentially a great marketing partner to any institution in the world. Our ability to actually build and operate institutions, physical institutions as well as online, is a huge advantage. A couple of years ago in Australia, the government awarded the first new license to open a private university that had been awarded in more than 20 years in that country, and we were fortunate enough to receive it because of our track record, because they viewed us as trustworthy, because they could see the results and the outcomes that we've delivered for students, and because they knew that we had the track record of being able to come into a country, assemble a team, understand the regulatory requirements, and literally build an institution from scratch. Very few of the companies that you mentioned, none of the companies that you mentioned, could do that. They may be able to market, deliver programs online, build curriculum and materials, and do it well. But I think that the full range of services, and again, Saudi Arabia would be a great example. We now have 8 colleges that we've built and operated under a new model called the Colleges of Excellence in Saudi Arabia, with the government as our customer, and they've awarded more contracts to us than anyone else because of that track record and capabilities of the company.
Any parts of your global reach that you see expanding either by country or region, and any areas where you see maybe pulling back in coming years?
I don't think there's so much pulling back. I think that one thing that does happen from time to time is that we realize there may be some institutions where the support we need from the regulators, if it's not sufficient, then we may have to pull back. But that's pretty rare. I think what's more likely is that we'll continue expanding. And one region that I'm very excited about now is Africa. We've started a university a couple of years ago in Morocco, which was one of the first private universities in that country, and that's now operational and moving into a wonderful new campus that we've built in Morocco. Last year, we announced our partnership with Monash University in Australia, which is ranked in the top 100 universities globally, and they had built a university in South Africa that was too far for them to manage the way they wanted to manage it, and so they selected us as their operating partner to come in and actually take over the operations of that branch, if you will, and operate it within parameters that we agreed together. And that's been a great success. And so now with the North and the South covered, I think that we will be able to move into other parts of Africa. And that gives me a huge satisfaction because far beyond any business prospects that represents, it's going to make a huge impact in the lives of tens or hundreds of thousands of students that might not otherwise have access to a higher education. So I'm very excited about Africa. I'm also very excited about our growth in Asia. I actually lived for a year in Asia to chart out Laureate's initial strategy, and I'm incredibly grateful for the warm reception that we've gotten by governments and regulators and students and employers all over Asia, and it's growing to become one of the more important regions in our company. So those are just a couple of examples.
Great. Well, that's all the time we have here. I want to thank you, though, for speaking with us. Definitely a lot of interesting things that Laureate is up to these days.
Thank you, Paul.